You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.
Good morning, friend. Welcome into the Mike Allen Show here on this Wednesday, December 21st, the winter solstice, also 4 days before the Feast of the Nativity. My pleasure to be with you. This is the O Oriens edition, taken, of course, from the O Antiphons, these seven titles of Christ in the Latin, which are meant to accentuate our anticipation of our Lord's arrival. Each one named for a different title of Christ from the scriptures in the Latin, and today's is O Oriens, which in means something like day spring or a star from the east, dawn of the east. Oh, that word Oriens, orient, east. We'll talk about that a little bit today. In the second hour, we're going to have as my guest John L. Allen Jr., gracious enough to give us a little bit of time. He's over in Rome, the Eternal City. What a place it must be to be there around the end of Advent and the Christmas season. I'm sure there's got to be a little bit of anxiety as well, given recent events in Berlin and the attack on the Christmas market there. Certainly got to be a lot of uneasiness in Europe in general. But we'll talk to John L. Allen, not so much about that as about the kerfuffle, about the Holy Father's recent apostolic exhortation on love, in particular married love, called Amoris Laetitia. You've got those four cardinals who submitted their questions to the Holy Father, the dubia, as it's said in Latin. Questions that the Holy Father has not responded to. They were seeking clarity regarding communion for the divorced and civilly remarried without an annulment and without a pledge to live as brother and sister. The Holy Father, perhaps sensing that they had other agendas, did not respond. They took it public. And there's just been a lot of back and forth in terms of the nature of this thing. John Allen wrote a column saying we need to turn the heat down in the rhetoric surrounding the debate, with words like schism and that sort of thing being tossed about. He's a longtime Vatican watcher and a devout Catholic. I'll be interested in John Allen's perspective on whether this is something unlike maybe he's seen before in his time of covering the church. So we'll have him on outside an Italian restaurant in Rome during the second hour today. Some other things we'll get into today. The longing for the bridegroom, a gun range at Liberty University, the no-win Syrian situation, and what to say and not to after a miscarriage. And that'll actually drive our question of the day as well, which I'll give you in the next segment. If you want to be a part of the program, 573-4BREAD-4, 573-4BREAD-4. You can email me, MikeAllenShow@gmail.com. Had our little Breadbox Media Christmas gathering yesterday. That was a lot of fun. Little potluck brunch, complete with mimosas, and also a little, oh, I don't know what they call it, dirty Santa exchange or Chinese gift exchange. I'm not sure how the Chinese got blamed with that one, but I walked away with an white elephant. There's another name that it's called. I walked away with a very helpful wealth building book from the 1990s. So, you know, when I'm broadcasting my show live from my Beverly Hills mansion or my Caribbean yacht, you'll know that I put that book to good use. But you know, one of the things Jennifer, who's a longtime worker here, Jennifer used to be known as Jennifer the call screener. Now she's Jennifer Ware of many hats. She had a little fake gift box in there, bacon-scented dryer sheets, and then there was something else, of course, inside the box. But she's got several of these fake boxes I guess she puts gifts in. I'm kind of disappointed that's a fake. Who wouldn't want a bacon-scented dryer sheet? I guess I've got the next best thing this morning. I grabbed my car. I was in a hurry to get here, as per usual. grab my coffee cup, my sort of Yeti knockoff Breadbox Media cup. And I was in a bit of a hurry, and I pulled it out of the sink at home, and I guess there was a little bacon grease in there, so it got on the outside of the cup. And I was in such a hurry, I really couldn't even wait for the water to warm up to clean it off. So I tried a little cold water, but didn't quite get it all off there. So I'm smelling on my hands bacon grease as I drink my coffee. I guess that'll be the next best thing of having some slices of bacon before me. Anyway, I digress. Like I said, if you want to be a part of the program, 573-4BREAD-4, or email me, MikeAllenShow@gmail.com. As I said, today's feast day, or not feast day, today's O Antiphon title is O Oriens. Now, I could read the Latin to you and butcher the pronunciation so that my Latin scholar friends would mock me, but I'll give you the English instead. O morning star, splendor of light eternal and sun of righteousness, come and enlighten those who dwell in darkness and the shadow of death. Now, I was reading about the O Antiphons. You know, as I told you about this dynamic of the acrostic, the first letter of each of these titles form. Right, so December 17th through 23rd, you've got seven of these titles. They form really the verses of O Come, Emmanuel. If you didn't know that, the hymn which gets sung to a great extent during the Advent season, because as I've said, there's so few really good Advent hymns, are structured around these O Antiphons, these prayers based on these titles of Christ. And if you take them, take the first letter of each, and you go in reverse order from the 23rd back to the 17th, 23rd is O Emmanuel, the 22nd is O Radix Jesse, Root of Jesse. Then the next one is Adonai, then Radix Jesse, then O Clavis David. You go back, it's Aero Cross in the Latin, E-R-O-C-R-A-S, tomorrow I will come. Now, there are scholars, some, I guess, historians, because these are very ancient. I mean, you could trace these back to the 3rd, 4th century. And evidently, there are those who argue that it's purely coincidence. In fact, one professor of theology argues that they were not deliberately arranged this way. Quote, there's little or no support in the sources that this is anything more than a coincidence. Such a cryptic medium is not a common quality of liturgical practice in theology. Moreover, the number of O Antiphons varied from church to church and religious community to community, and those without Aero Cross did not fashion their antiphons to construct a cryptic message. Well, aren't you the wet blanket? Well, okay, maybe we'll call it not coincidence, maybe we'll call it providence. I mean, we Catholics do believe in that sort of thing, right? That's a word that probably it needs to be recovered a little bit, is that word providence. Much like the word vouchsafe. I'm kind of on my own personal quest to bring the word vouchsafe back into usage, particularly when it comes to the faith. I love this idea that our life is vouchsafed, hidden with Christ in God. But anyway, whether it was providence, coincidence, whatever, or intentional, whatever you want to say, I think it's also very interesting and very providential, if not deliberately chosen, that today's is O Oriens, O Morning Star, or Dawn from the East, because today happens to be, of course, the winter solstice. The longest night of the year, shortest day of the year. From this point forward, of course, day will grow increasingly longer and night increasingly shorter. And when you combine all that together, right, with the solstice and the increasing sunshine, the sunlight, with the Nativity of our Lord, with the Advent candle which shines in the darkness, you get more and more a sense of exactly what Advent is and the anticipation that it is. This light from the east. Did you know that for many centuries, and I don't think it's as common anymore, when Catholic churches were built, they were always built facing east. There's a phrase, ad orientum, in the Latin, right? There's that orient word again, a word that which means the east. Ad Orientem means toward the east. Because the idea being that Christ's return, he will appear, in a sense, from the east. And so there's this, as with everything in the Catholic Church, nothing is ever by accident. And so this idea, even in our architecture, that we're anticipating the Christ who comes to meet us. Now, when we get into the second hour, we'll talk about today's readings and how perfect they are as well in terms of the nature of this day, this O Oriens, and the shortest day of the year, and the increasing light, and the impending celebration, liturgical celebration of our Lord's birth. But this facing east, this is why, you know, before the Second Vatican Council, the priest in celebrating Mass would be ad orientem in his posture, and particularly in the liturgy of the Eucharist, the great sacrifice of the Mass. In other words, it wasn't the case, and this is, it just drives me crazy when I hear this term, the priest having his back to the people. No, it was the priest facing with the people toward the east. Now, it's not toward a particular city, you know, like the, you know, Muslims kneel toward Mecca, for example, or perhaps Jews toward Jerusalem. We toward the east, together. And I think there is a great beauty in that, in the churches, because not only, of course, do we look for Christ meeting us at the end of human history, his return, but he comes to meet us in the liturgy, in the Mass. We'll be back with more. Our question of the day on the other side of the break. This is The Mike Allen Show.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.
Minutes past the hour, you're back on the Mike Allen Show here on Breadbox Media. Check out what we're doing, what we're about, breadboxmedia.com. I particularly like the whole concept of a parish stream. Say you go to a Catholic parish, you want some sort of a communication hub and also something that can be a source of encouragement, of teaching, of evangelization. We aim to please here at Breadbox Media. You can have your own parish stream, right? So that someone can download the app, identify the parish, and then therefore, of course, you get all the same programming, all our contributors from coast to coast and across the heartland here, all with different perspectives, temperaments, personalities, topics, but all through the lens of the Catholic faith, very much centered in the church's teaching. But you also get the three-minute breaks after every 12-minute segment that your parish can use as you want. You can use it for sort of in-house communications, teaching or encouragement from staff or the pastor. You can also have commercial advertisements from people within the parish, perhaps the same people who advertise on the back of your bulletin and generate revenue for your parish. It, not to be cliche, but it really can be a win-win-win all the way around. So check it out and contact breadboxmedia.com. Maybe if you're interested, shoot an email to jennifer@breadboxmedia.com. Our question of the day has to do with grief and helpful and unhelpful words. I came across an article, it's actually 5 years old, called Things People Said After My Miscarriage. And someone listed the top five best things to say. And she listed, well, I'll give these to you later. But it got me thinking, number one, about things not to say as well. My wife and I have lost three pregnancies, three children in utero. Most of those pregnancies were at about the 7-week mark.
And I heard a whole gamut of different things. And I understand people, believe me, people struggle with what to say. They feel like they want to say something, which oftentimes is it should be the first interior signal that you should say nothing. If you're feeling you should say something, you don't know what to say, think again. Because I've had people say crazy things. Like, I remember after one, I think it was after our sixth child, a woman, I was a Methodist pastor at the time. So he had all my seven children before becoming Catholic. As I say, we got tired of being asked if we were Catholic. We decided to make it official. But I remember a woman, well-meaning older lady, I guess, came up to me in our congregation and said, well, maybe that's just the Lord telling you that's enough. So God took out our baby to send us a message. Gotcha. Any other divinely inspired insights you want to share with me? Again, people struggle with what to say. So I thought I'd broaden that out for our question of the day. And that is, what is the most helpful thing and the least helpful thing anyone has ever said to you after the loss or the death of a loved one? 573-4BREAD-4, 573-4BREAD-4, or you can email me, MikeAllenShow@gmail.com, or you can post a thought on Facebook or on Twitter. And I'll share a few of these as we go along, some comments I've gotten on Facebook on this question. Deborah says, most helpful, what do you need me to do for you? Least helpful, how did he or she pass away, or he or she is in a better place? That's a toss-up. Rebecca says, I feel uplifted when someone tells me an inspiring memory that includes themselves and my loved one. Yeah, I like that. Kathy says, it's been helpful to hear others compliment my precious Michael and tell me what a good man he was. It's only been 6 months since he passed. I'm so tired of hearing, you will get through this Christmas. Next year will be easier. I don't want it to ever be easier to let go of the love we had, she writes. Laura says, God needed him more than you did. No, just don't say that. Heaven gained an angel. Nice image, but people become saints. Angels are not people. So I'll share some more of those a little bit later. You want to add your own, 573-4BREAD-4, 573-4BREAD-4, or you could email me, MikeAllenShow@gmail.com. You know, if you struggle with what to say in those circumstances, just say, I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry for your loss. That's simple. That's pretty much foolproof right there. And just be a presence in someone's life in the midst of their grief. You can chime in if you want, as I said, as we go along. Sports-wise, big game tonight, at least for us here in Central Kentucky, where I'm broadcasting from. Kentucky versus Louisville. This is a bitter rivalry. I mean, you knew it was bad a number of years ago when they played in the Final Four and two guys who were in the dialysis clinic got into a rumble. I think one of them was even hooked up to the machine. there's been this interesting dynamic in the Kentucky football rivalry, which, you know, goes with both football and basketball. Certainly Louisville's had the better of it in football, typically Kentucky the better of it in basketball. But there has been this strange dynamic, and I think this is maybe like the 23rd consecutive year that we've played in both football and basketball. And I think in at least 20 or 21 of the previous 22 years, the team that has won the football game has lost the basketball game. It's really, really strange. So given that Kentucky pulled off a major, maybe one of the biggest upsets in Kentucky football history over Louisville in football, it does put me a little bit on an uneasy place for tonight's game in Louisville. I mean, I think Kentucky is the more talented squad, but they're young. It will be heated, and Louisville's hungry because, like I said, I think since John Calipari has been at Kentucky, he's like 8-1 or something like that against Rick Pitino. So anyway, it's odd. The game's usually played on a weekend, but tune it in tonight and check it out. It really is an intense rivalry. And I think in some way, some have argued that this actually is the best rivalry in college basketball. Better than that other one down there on Tobacco Road between Duke and UNC, who play twice a year. Maybe familiarity sort of breeds a lack of contempt. So we'll see. The coaches themselves and the players, I don't think, because most of the players don't come from the state of Kentucky, I don't think they feel the rivalry in their bones like the fans do. But we'll see how it all shakes out. You'll either hear sadness in my voice tomorrow or a little skip in my step, no doubt. I read an interesting piece. There's a columnist up in the Cincinnati, Ohio area that I enjoy. His name is, they call him Doc. His name is Paul Doherty. And he wrote a piece that I just came across actually this morning commenting on this new phenomenon, and I expect that you'll see it as a trend, of elite college football players who are predicted to go highly in the upcoming draft skipping out on a more of a ceremonial type bowl game, not one that's going to impact a pursuit of the national championship, skipping out on it to concentrate on preparation for the draft and not to risk injury. You first saw this with Leonard Fournette of LSU, and now Christian McCaffrey, the running back for Stanford, has decided to do the same thing. Now, I will admit to you that I have a particular degree of sympathy for these players who make this decision. I mean, you think about their whole future is at stake here, right? I mean, they signing a contract that, if they manage the money well, could set them up for life. And freak injuries do happen, particularly in football, my goodness. And the possibility that, you know, you could blow out a knee, that you could have a horrific injury like a Teddy Bridgewater has had on the pro level up with the Minnesota Vikings that may put your whole future in jeopardy, has got to be a factor that one considers. And you wonder, to what degree will this continue to play out? Will you see this happen with college basketball players who become aware, for example, late in the season? You know, let's take somebody like last year. Who was the kid last year for LSU who went so high in the draft? Ben Simmons, who went number one in the NBA draft. LSU was pretty apparent was not going to make the NCAA tournament. Every game Ben Simmons plays, he was almost guaranteed the number one pick. Every game he plays, he puts himself at risk. But I'm going to post a link to this article from Paul Doherty, because he sees it a little bit differently. Trying to push not just players, but everybody out of this generation of me. And it's not just the players. You've got coaches who bail on their teams, no matter what kind of contract they've signed, to sign a higher dollar amount, strike while the iron's hot. And there's a bit of a double standard that we hold coaches, that we don't hold coaches to, that we try to hold players to. But he calls out McCaffrey in this piece. Says it would have been nice. He understands it on a financial level and on a practical basis and so forth. But he doesn't buy in the whole thing of college athletes like McCaffrey getting exploited. I mean, he's getting a Stanford education for free, for heaven's sake. So I'm going to post a link to this because it's really good, and we may get into this a little bit more tomorrow. I think Doc may have tilted my sympathies a little bit on this well-written piece. We'll be back with more. This is The Mike Allen Show. You're listening to Breadbox Media.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app. Change the world.
We're We're right at the bottom of the hour, back on the Mike Allen Show. 573-4-BREAD-4 if you want to chime in. What's the most helpful thing someone has said to you after the death of a loved one? And what is the least helpful thing someone has said to you? 573-4-BREAD-4. Call or text, email me, MikeAllenShow@gmail.com, or you can post a thought on Facebook or on Twitter. Some other comments we've gotten on this on Facebook. Let's see. Susan says, most helpful thing, you are allowed to be mad. Let it out. Cry. Cuss. Fight with God. He's there for us always, even when we are mad and don't understand. Yeah, you're in good company, those circumstances. Like I said, read the Psalms. You'll find every human emotion expressed. No reason to hide it. God knows all anyway. Nicole says, I have a cousin by marriage who used to say she guessed my papa would be next after anyone died in my family. It was less than helpful. My goodness, really? Janie says, least helpful, this happened to make you stronger. Most helpful, is it okay if we clean your house? Molly says, the best thing is not a word, just a hug. Also, I'm sorry. Worst, God just needed another angel. Not true and terrible theology. I did want to share Brian's here. He said, when my wife and I lost a baby boy at 37 weeks gestation, several wise people simply told us, we love you and we're with you. They backed those words up with action as well. Job's friends first sat with him silently because they saw how great his suffering was. Some people grasp the extraordinary comfort of mere presence with someone who is hurting so deeply. It is unfortunate that in Job's case, those same friends eventually did speak and caused things to go south to the point that Job finally uttered the most brilliant response to unhelpful comments to a grieving person. If only you would be altogether silent, Job said. For you, that would be wisdom. I have since attempted to discern when each form of wisdom is called for. Great response there, Brian, no doubt. 573-4-BREAD-4 if you've got your own to add. I got a couple of emails here from Bonnie, fellow Kentucky fan for the Louisville game tonight. She says, go Cats, from the Kentucky people that live in Gatorville, down in the Sunshine State. And she also has this comment. I was talking about Christian McCaffrey and the decision to skip out on his bowl game for Stanford, a kid who's guaranteed to be a first-round draft pick, not risking injury, preparing for the draft, missing a bowl game that will not impact the national championship pursuit. Monty says, isn't that taking the team out of the game, which got them where they are? That's the me factor. It's a good point. And actually, Paul Daugherty, in the excellent article, which I posted on the show's Facebook page, look it up, Mike Allen Show, he makes that exact same point. So we'll get into this maybe a little bit more tomorrow, because I do think it is, I can see merits on both sides of the argument on this in this deal. 573-4-BREAD-4 if you want to chime in. We are behind time for our What Were You Thinking nominees of the day, and maybe we should give some of these to those who say stupid things to people in their grief, but I digress. Again, we span the globe. Go dumb or go home, as we like to say. First one here, actually, this is a post from the Absecon Police Department. This is in New Jersey, which runs second to Florida on the number of the What Were You Thinking nominees, I believe. Anyway, the police posted a description of how this particular attempted crime went down. Kenny and Lenny are twins. Twins presumably share a strong connection and do many things together. This could include committing crimes together. Today, Kenny and Lenny were at the ShopRite here in town, where they allegedly loaded up a large bag with 36 packs of Dove soap and exited without paying. Which, of course, raises a question. What are you doing? Can soap be used for some sort of drug manufacturing? Not sure why you would decide to steal soap, but anyway, the dubious duo attempted their getaway with store employees hot on their trail. They escaped out the exit, but were introduced to the cold, frosty ground by a strategically placed trash can. Those sometimes jump out of nowhere, as the police said. The key to dodging it would have been a little communication between the two, with Kenny on one handle of the bag and Lenny on the other.
it became imperative they pick the same side of the trash can to navigate around. They didn't. So they sprung to their feet and began putting some more distance between themselves and their pursuers until a shopping cart appeared. The cart, not wanting to be outdone by the can, reintroduced them to the hard-packed pavement. Slightly worse for wear and perhaps fighting off those feelings of discouragement, Kenny and Lenny pressed onward, rounding the building with freedom in sight and the aromatic lilac musk of Dove soap permeating the December chill. This is great from a police department, isn't it? The twins came face to face with Patrol Cavalier. Cavalier was investigating a minor motor vehicle accident on the side of the building. How serendipitous. So the patrolman quickly apprehended. Of course, this has spawned now a whole host of dad joke puns about this escapade. You know, that the two tried to slip away with their soap theft, or they didn't have a clean getaway, and so forth. So anyway, so if you're going to steal something, don't steal stuff that just lobs up softballs for people's bad puns. The second nominee we're going to give today is to a Midland Beach man. This is Staten Island, New York. He pleaded guilty to collecting more than $37,000 in workers' compensation benefits. Eugene Reams claimed to have been injured while working as a lineman for Verizon and began receiving the benefits back in 2007 based on those injuries. Unfortunately, in 2012, his wife and cousin opened a kickboxing business, and he began working there. He was captured on surveillance videos doing kicking and punching moves. He continued working as a kickboxing instructor through May 2014 while falsely telling physicians he was incapacitated and not working. Yeah, I would say there aren't many jobs that if you can be a kickboxing instructor, you can handle the physical demands of it. Wow. But the winner, we're going to give the winner. This is just amazing. Here we are at the end of the school semester. Middleburg Heights teacher disciplined, this from Middleburg Heights, Ohio, after inappropriate lesson. This contacted the news here because a children's math teacher gave them a lesson that was sexually inappropriate. The teacher has been disciplined after the students snapped a photo of the assignment. So yesterday we had students capturing bad cafeteria food. Today, an inappropriate math test question. Here was the math test question the teacher decided to put on the exam. You ready for this? Tony can send 5 texts and 3 nudes in 19 minutes. He could also send 3 texts and 1 nude in 9 minutes. How long would it take him to send 1 text and 1 nude? I mean, in what universe, Mr. Daniel Rapp, the math teacher, is that an advisable problem? I understand about trying to be in the kid's language, but a math problem about sexting, really? I wonder what the discipline is. Hopefully it's pretty significant. I mean, that's lose your job kind of stuff to me. Anyway, so if you've got a nominee, we'd love to hear from you. 573-4BREAD-4 or email me, MikeAllenShow@gmail.com. I was reading an interesting piece. Of course, you know, you got the terrible situation going on in Berlin right now. And we need to pray not only for the victims of that horrible attack, the nightmare of a truck driven into a crowd of people, but those who have lost, those who are injured, those who are grieving the death, for law enforcement to be able to apprehend if, in fact, the killer is still at large. And we need to pray for protection for persons throughout the world in this time of constant, it seems, violence. I read an interesting piece on The Economist about the situation in Aleppo and what a moral dilemma Christian leaders have there in Syria. An almost impossible situation that it is. Because, you know, you've got President Bashar al-Assad, who in some ways... you know, who has, of course, been guilty of war crimes and atrocities against his own people. Yet at the same time, as the leader of Syria, he has offered some protection. It's not unlike the situation was in Iraq under Saddam Hussein. Saddam Hussein, who was a ruthless dictator, and yet did provide some degree of stability and protection for the Christian minorities in Syria. And so what you have when you think about things like an Arab Spring or the revolution, the civil war there in Syria, it's not simply like you have a revolution of persons who are seeking to bring Western-style freedom to Syria. Oftentimes, those revolutionaries are are radical Muslims. And therefore, Christians are going to be in grave danger once the dictator, who has more perhaps secular motivations, is removed. And it really is. We'll get into this a little bit more on the other side of the break. It is a very difficult situation for Christian leaders to sort of parse out. We'll be back in just a minute. This is the Mike Allen Show.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app. Change the world.
Minutes before the hour, you're back on the Mike Allen Show. You're on Breadbox Media. If you miss any part of the show or you want to catch an old one or listen to any of our other contributors, just go to breadboxmedia.com. You can follow the link to podcasts. You can also go to iTunes, Google Play, or Podbean and subscribe. Also invite you to become a friend of your favorite show, and through a monthly contribution, you can receive access to exclusive online content and know that you are supporting the show that you believe in. So check it all out at breadboxmedia.com. Again, my question of the day, I come across an article, as I said, that talked about the helpful things that people might say to you after a miscarriage. The top five being, what can I bring you? This is terrible, horrible, unfair. You will be in my prayers. How are you feeling? Or number one, I'm so sorry for your loss. And conversely, of course, there are terrible things to say to someone after a miscarriage. But my question is a little bit more broader. After any death of a loved one, what's the most helpful thing that you've had someone say to you? What's the least helpful thing? If you want to chime in, 573-4-BREAD-4, 573-4-BREAD-4. You can email me, MikeAllenShow@gmail.com. Let's see what other responses we've got. You can also post on Facebook or on Twitter through social media. Let's see. Steven says, most helpful to me when my wife died unexpectedly was an offer to stay the night and read stories to my children in my living room as they slowly fell asleep. My friend Greg stayed with my family for the first two nights and helped with funeral arrangements and countless details. Any offer of help and friendship is always appreciated, if just to let someone know they are not alone. Yeah, very good. So chime in. We'd love to hear from you. 573-4-BREAD-4 or email me, MikeAllenShow@gmail.com. Anyway, back into this whole article in The Economist about the situation in Syria and the difficulty there. This columnist Erasmus writes this, just like Iraq, Syria hosts an array of Christian confessions, distinguished by the positions their forebears took in church councils of up to 15 centuries ago. Some are in communion with Rome,
others with Greek and Russian orthodoxy. Still others have subtle doctrinal differences with all the above, but keep friendly terms with their co-religionists elsewhere. Whatever they believe, virtually all, I mean, all these different Christian groups, I'm assuming he means, virtually all have accepted Russia's renewed claim, originally dating from the 19th century, to be the protector of Christians in the region. Quote, Russia has given hope to the people of Syria, unquote, according to Patriarch Ignatios Ephraim II, leader of the Syrian Orthodox Church. Now, it'd be interesting. I'm going to have Father Tom Galloway, my Orthodox priest friend, who's on monthly. He'll be on the program Friday. I'm going to ask him about this. I guess I'd not thought about it in those terms. You know, we think about the Syria, the Aleppo situation, the bombing in Aleppo, the deaths of civilians, those who find themselves caught between the rebel forces and Assad's forces. And we try to make this, like so many of these situations in the Middle East, it is so complicated on so many levels. And what to do, you can appreciate why our politicians oftentimes don't know quite what to do. Back to this piece by Erasmus, it says, given the situation of their co-religionists, Western church leaders have hesitated to make strong statements about Syria. To defend Mr. Assad seems morally outrageous, but calls for his removal risk sounding like a death knell for fellow Christians. Because if you do have a Muslim spring among some of the more extremist elements, it's not going to be good for Christians any more than in Egypt. The Arab Spring there was good for Christians. It was not at all. Again, you have the unfortunate situation of despotic dictators, but if they are removed, then all hell really breaks loose. This piece from Erasmus continues, the Vatican, both well-informed and well-connected in Syria, has acted with more subtlety than other Christian authorities. On December 11th, it announced that its envoy in Damascus had delivered a letter to Mr. Assad, which, while condemning extremist violence from all quarters, urged him, quote, to ensure that humanitarian law is fully respected with respect to the protection of civilians. This was a way of signaling that Pope Francis knew the ghastly effects of Aleppo's bombardment, but he also accepted that there were other bad guys in the arena. Maybe it's a little bit like going to a movie, you know, where there's no redeeming character. It's like when I watched the first episode of House of Cards, decided I couldn't watch any more of it because there was no person of virtue at all. I mean, you gotta have at least a little bit of virtue in there. I mean, you know, at least Breaking Bad, with all of his problems, you know, Jesse Pinkman has a little bit of virtue. Anyway, the piece continues. A retired Anglican bishop, the Pakistani-born Michael Nazir Ali, made waves in September by meeting Mr. Assad along with a party of concerned Britons, including a couple of fellow peers. The encounter was condemned in Westminster for giving a propaganda coup to the war criminal, but the bishops defended the meeting in measured terms, insisting that he and his companions had put hard questions to the president about the barrel bombing and torture of civilians. He asked the question, Erasmus does, is it possible for a Christian cleric to stand anywhere in Syria and speak with integrity about misdeeds and suffering on all sides? He says two very brave ones have tried. Father Paolo Dall'Oglio, an Italian Jesuit with long years of experience in Syria, voiced sympathy for the democratic opposition when it emerged in 2011 and was expelled by the government. He tried re-entering Syria in 2013 via rebel-held territory in the hope of bringing succor to friends there. He then disappeared. Another Jesuit, Franz von der Lute, bore witness against the cruelty of the warring parties in a different way, against all prudent advice. He stayed in the city of Homs as it was under attack from government forces. And being defended mainly by Sunni extremists, he was assassinated in April 2014. So to rephrase the question, Erasmus asks, is it possible for a Christian cleric in Syria to speak out with integrity and remain alive? One awesomely courageous Syrian priest has managed to do that. Evidently, he was asked in October what he thought of outside powers intervening in his country. He began by saying, and on this point, every single Christian in Syria would concur that Saudi Arabia should be restrained from fomenting Sunni extremism. But he also went on to say something that should give all Assad-loving Christians pause for thought. The U.S. has been bombing Syria and Iraq for years, and now the Russians are doing so too. And what have they achieved? Have they stopped the terrorist violence? Absolutely not. More clearly than many Christians with a stake in Syria, Father Murad seems to sense that jihadist extremism will not be buried under the rubble of eastern Aleppo. It will simply migrate and metastasize. Wow. Man, pray. You know, these are we're talking about ancient Christian lands here in a place like Syria. Anyway, let's look back in history a little bit on this day, December 21st throughout the ages. Take a walk through the lens of chronology here. 72 AD, according to tradition, Thomas the Apostle dies. His burial place there in India is patron of that country, saint and martyr, apostle and martyr. 1891, that's what, 125 years ago, the first game of basketball, based on rules created by James Naismith, was played by 18 students in Springfield, Massachusetts. Man, it's hard to believe there was a time without basketball. 1913, the first crossword puzzle published in the New York World. I am a crossword fan. Never got into Sudoku, other puzzles, but a crossword, I'll do any. And in my life goal, one of them, not the only one, that'd be lame. One of my life goals is to complete a New York Times Sunday crossword puzzle. Still haven't done it. Happy birthday to Phil Donahue, 81. Jane Fonda, 79. Frank Zappa, 76. You can be in there with Keith Richards, that guys you never imagined would live that long. Samuel L. Jackson, 68. Ray Romano, 59. Kiefer Sutherland, 50. Kiefer Sutherland has just one of those faces that makes a good villain, you know? Let's see. In 1970, Elvis Presley met with Richard Nixon in the Oval Office to discuss fighting drugs. That was an interesting choice. Let's see. The Lockerbie disaster. A Pan Am flight destroyed by a terrorist bomb in 1988 over Scotland, killing 258 on board. May those who were lost rest in peace. And also, this is Chris Everett's birthday today. She's 62 years old. We'll be back with a new hour. This is the Mike Allen Show. You're listening to Breadbox Media.
Thank you for listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.